Hello and welcome to this week's Green Shoots, a history of Irish football. Coming up on this week's podcast, we are taking a look at one of our greatest ever footballers as we talk about Bud Ahern. We hear from Gary about Bud's time internationally and him being a part of some of the Republic of Ireland's greatest ever wins. Then I talk to William Foster from Hatters Heritage, a Luton Town FC historical charity, about his time at Luton Town, the team where he spent the majority of his club football and where he worked, retired and died too. Don't forget to share the show on your social media channels to let more people find out about the history and heritage of Irish football and want to share your own stories about it while you're at it. Turn on your notifications on whatever podcast platform you use so that you get notified straight away when a new episode drops. Now, Tom Bud Ahern is one of Ireland's finest ever footballers, but what do we know about him? We'll be hearing from William Foster from Hatters Heritage later in the podcast, but first, I talked with Gary about Bud's early career and his international career with both the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland football teams.
Yeah, so I mean, Bud is probably the greatest footballer I think Limerick has ever produced. I say that with the utmost respect for the likes of Steve Finnan, Don Givens. Obviously, we had our own Alfinucan, Kevin Fitzpatrick, Johnny Walsh, Sean Cusack, and we'd many, Togsy Kinnean, Billy Hayes, we'd many Limerick men that wore the green. And Bud actually didn't play, he wasn't capped while at Limerick. I mean, he played in Limerick's first season. He won the Munster Cup in 37-38 as a very young man. He scored in the final. He was in the army during the war. He was stationed in Crosshaven. And he wasn't transferred until 1946 when the war ended. He joined Belfast Celtic and he missed out. I mean, if you take it, he had a career from 1938 to 1946 when there weren't any internationals. You can imagine how many caps he missed out on. And then if you put into context the number of caps he got, I mean, he got 16 caps for the Republic of Ireland, which was, or what is now the Republic of Ireland, in what was, that was an incredible total for the time. And he also played six times for what is now Northern Ireland. Four of those are full internationals and two were, I'll go on and talk about them, victory internationals. And he played in some, even to this day, some of the most iconic games that are still being talked about. And he was part of them. So, for example, he was part of the only Irish men's team to ever beat Spain away from home, to beat Spain on Spanish soil. And he was also part of the only Irish team to ever beat England on English soil. So he was part of the last All-Ireland team. He was part of the Belfast Celtic team, the last club side to play Scotland. And the reason they're the last club side to play Scotland is they beat them 2-0 in the USA, the reigning British champions as they were then. So, I mean, Bud has played in some incredible games, and I'm not even counting then a 3-2 win over Germany for the Republic of Ireland. He was part of that team as well, played, tried to qualify for a couple of World Cups. So an incredible career, a fantastic player, obviously before my time, but I heard so many stories about him, not just from my father, from the other fans that used to go on the popular side in the 70s. I mean, Bud was a legend of Limerick football.
Yeah, and he had a longish career. He played into his late 30s. He had a great longevity to his career.
He had, yeah. I mean, he didn't go cross channel to Luton Town until he was almost 30. I think he went in the end of the 40 or towards the end of the 48-49 season. And he played for, I think, was it 7 years then? I know you have a different interview on his Luton Town career, which was obviously very special as well. And I mean, he stayed on. He lived the rest of his life in Luton as well, raised his family there.
Yeah, he's very much a Luton man. They still think about him there quite a lot. And, you know, I think one of the interesting things is that he seems to have been just a grafter, a real hard worker. And whatever the scenario, whatever he was asked to do, he just kind of did it, but he did it to the best of his ability.
Yes, I mean, he was. But, I mean, he was also a really, really talented footballer. And even when he burst on the scene during the 37-38 as a very, very young man in Limerick, it was obvious. And obviously said went up north, won everything with Belfast Celtic, and then went on to Luton Town.
When we kind of look back on the, I suppose, the pantheon of Irish, great Irish footballers and stuff like that, with respect to, you know, what happened with Jack Charlton and all the great players that came in that era and so on, that perhaps people like Bud kind of get lost in the passage of time about how great they were as players and the kind of careers that they had as well, because he was playing in England as well. He did get to play against some of the best teams in England while there as well. So perhaps maybe his legacy, I suppose, for want of a better word, is maybe forgotten a bit.
Yeah, I mean, no, I think sadly it's probably true about many of the greats of that period, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. I mean, there was no TV in those days. Yeah. So you are depending on the written word, of the word of mouth, of what fans will say as well. But, I mean, we had some really top players in those days. I mean, Jackie Carey of Manchester United was Football Player of the Year. You had the likes of Peter Farrell and Tommy Eglinton. I mean, that team that beat England in 1949 had some incredible players. The team that went to Madrid and beat Spain. I mean, it's there was some great players. Sadly, we don't have any or very, very little footage to actually prove that. I mean, there's so little footage out there of those times, and if it is, it's kind of grainy black and white footage. And so how do you compare? I said it already. How do you compare a Bud Ahern with a Steve Finnan? I mean, Steve went to World Cup, won the Champions League, so maybe I'm being a bit unfair. He was also a son of Limerick, but I don't know. You know, it's you have to go by the stories and what's been said, but the fact that he was there and he was there for so long, and he became a mainstay as a fullback on the national team, and indeed on the Ireland team or Northern Ireland team, as it would be known now, and played and started so many big occasions. I'll go on and talk about those games, but they were huge. We haven't done them since, you know. Mm.
And I suppose as well that the other side of it too is perhaps maybe not to do that thing that we do, which is to compare kind of like for like players in very different eras. You know, the game had progress massively by the time, you know, you mentioned Steve Finnan, so there's a huge, there's you know, 50-60 years in the passage of time before Steve Finnan comes along, so the game has evolved and it's moved in a different way. So maybe the best thing is to just acknowledge that, you know, for the era they were still great players, and not do that thing where we like to put people up, pit them against each other in terms of quality.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair comment. I mean, the players then were good enough to be the best that was available at the time. Mm. And they were the superstars of their era. And yeah, I think that's probably all you can say, because, I mean, you go back even a little bit further when Bud was breaking through. I mean, Jimmy Dunn scored something like, was it 13 goals in 15 games? Mm-hmm. Something like that off the top of my head. But I mean, can you compare him to Robbie Keane? You know, it's it's just, it's different times. But I mean, they were the heroes of their era, and people travelled. They were the heroes. Football was meant just as much to the people going in the 30s and 40s and 50s as it does to those of us going today. And they had their heroes, they had their superstars. And I suppose all we can say is the best at the time were certainly good enough to be the best then. And maybe we can all look back with a bit of nostalgia, and I can say, oh, I remember those teams, and maybe they were better than the ones we have today or something like that. But I mean, I remember going on the popular side in the Markets Field and the guys telling me, we'd far better teams in the 40s and the 50s, you know. So it is what it is, I suppose.
Talk to us a little about some of those. You mentioned some of the iconic games that he was a part of. Maybe we might elaborate a little bit on that and maybe we can look at why they were so iconic.
He made his debut on the Iberian Tour in 1946. So we lost 3-1 in Portugal and then went to Madrid to play Spain in front of a raucous Spanish crowd, over 50,000 people, which included General Franco, his wife and daughter. And W.P. Murphy, writing in the Irish Independent, seemed to talk the only chant the Spanish had, and he was there, was Franco, Franco. So I don't want to get into the Spanish Civil War, but certainly we managed to silence the Spanish crowd with an absolutely brilliant display. And Bud was part of a great rear guard action. Con Martin, the defeat in Portugal, the only goalkeeper on the trip, Ned Courtney, got injured, having left in 3 goals. And Con Martin, who was an outfield player and who was the star, or one of the stars of Goodison, ended up going in goal and had the game of his life in goal. And we beat the Spanish 1-0. And I suppose another thing to say is if you ask people the goal scorer that day, there are probably very, very few Irish fans. The name Paddy Sloan, or Joshua Sloan, he was known as Paddy. Joshua Sloan doesn't exactly trip off the tongue, but he got the only goal. And it remains the only time an Irish men's side has gone to Spain and beaten Spain in Spain. In 1946, Bud was part of that team. Made his full debut. He'd already played a couple of victory internationals for Northern Ireland. Made his full debut against England in Belfast. Strangely, wasn't picked for the Republic of Ireland 2 days later, although he was good enough for an All-Ireland team. But, well, another match after he left Belfast Celtic for Luton.
Just to say on that Spanish game, I managed to, by pure digging deeper and deeper and deeper, find some clips of Ireland playing Spain. I think I shared them with you a couple of weeks ago. And one of the things that I read about was Ireland's defeat came a catalyst, I suppose if you put it that way, for Spain to kind of redevelop its thinking with football and how they played football and how they kind of developed as a team as well. So I suppose in one way, Ireland kind of helped to kind of reinvent Spanish football as well by defeating them. So it was a major defeat for the Spanish as well. Even though it was a friendly, it made them reevaluate how exactly they were playing football and how they could improve as well. So it did have a big impact.
So that's quite a claim that the likes of Bud Ahern and Con Martin and Joshua Sloan are responsible for the way Spain play football today. But we'll take it.
I think the point, like, because they were going through a particularly bad period where they had good players, but they weren't developing as a team. They weren't playing that kind of Spanish style of football that we know. So they had very talented players, but they just weren't kind of making it work, if you want to put it that way. So I think there is a thought process behind that after a couple of defeats that included Ireland's win there as well, that there had to be a redevelopment, a new thinking in Spanish football to avoid these kind of, I suppose, what they consider to be an embarrassing result.
But it embarrassing for Spain, but an incredible win for an Irish team. And as I said, it hasn't been done since, or hadn't been done before that.
Yeah.
I'll move forward to 1949, and Bud had left Belfast Celtic. He'd won the league, won the cup, won. He had actually played in the infamous game in Windsor Park as well when Jimmy Jones's leg was broken. But he went on tour as a guest player with Belfast Celtic, even though he'd signed for Luton at that stage. And as part of that tour in America, they played the full Scottish national team, and they beat them 2-0 in New York in an incredible result, an incredible shock. And such a shock. Scotland decided we're not playing club sides anymore after that. And so Bud was part of that team, a game that's gone down in history. A few months later, he was part of the team on the 21st September 1949. And names that I remembered when the likes of Con Martin and Peter Farrell got the goals as we beat England 2-0. We became the first foreign team, as the first non-UK side, to beat England on English soil. People often talk about Hungary at Wembley, but that was 1953, and we'd beaten them 4 years earlier. And it remains the only win for an Irish or Republic of Ireland side away to England. And Bud, again, was part of that team, a historic win. And a year later, so Bud actually played in World Cup qualifying for the Republic of Ireland for the 1950 World Cup. And he also played in the, right, was still playing in the qualifiers for 54 in the games against France. Wow. But in 1950, another historic game was the last, well, it was a nil-all draw between Wales and Ireland in Wrexham, a pretty nondescript game. The British Championship was already decided. England had won it. But it turned out to be the last ever All-Ireland team, All-Ireland team, because the IFA had been picking an All-Ireland team. The FAI had tried it briefly. They did it on that Iberian tour that I talked about. But the FAI had stopped, had only restricted themselves to players born within the 26 counties. The IFA continued to pick a 32-county side. But in 1950, at the FIFA Congress, the FAI went to FIFA and successfully won a case against the IFA to stop the IFA from picking our players, inverted commas. So the team, and part of the reason I think that, and it suppose it became obvious, was the home championship had served as the qualifiers for the 1950 World Cup, but we'd also played Finland and Sweden in trying to qualify for that World Cup. So the likes of Bud Ahern had two chances to go to the World Cup, and that was seen as being unfair. And so that team that played Wales and Wrexham was the last All-Ireland team to take the field. So Bud was part of that. He continued to represent the Republic of Ireland right up to 1953, was a regular in the team. As I said, played in the famous win over Germany 3-2 in 1951, played in the World Cup qualifiers against France. I will mention a Limerick highlight as well, because in a friendly match against France in Dalymount Park in 1952, it was the only time three Limerick men took the field in an Irish jersey. Bud was obviously at Luton Town at the time. Sean Cusick of Limerick, Limerick FC, played. And Johnny Gavin, who we've talked about before as well, was also on the team. So three of the 11 players that lined out were from Limerick that day.
Yeah, absolutely. And that shouldn't be taken for granted either, considering if you look at now, it's been so long since we've had a Limerick man playing international football as well.
Yeah, and I mean, I did mention Steve Finnan, and he's Limerick. He was born in Janesborough. He's definitely one of our own. But and as is Don Givens, but both of them left Limerick at a very, very young age and were developed elsewhere. So, I mean, you have to go back probably to the likes of Johnny Walsh before you have someone developed in Limerick that played, that got capped. And you've even got to go back before that to Joe Waters, I think, was the last Limerick man to play a competitive international for the Republic of Ireland. And that was back in the 1970s, in 79 against Northern Ireland, the last Limerick man. Not the last Limerick man, but the person who grew up in Limerick, if you know what I mean. Obviously, Steve Finnan was, as I said, he's a Limerick man.
Absolutely, yeah, definitely is. So where then, considering all that, do we put Bud Ahern in the pantheon of Irish football?
I know I've gone on and said he was the best player to ever come out of Limerick, but I mean, am I contradicting myself now? Because he's certainly up there. Look, he was one of the greats. He was one, probably the most talked about name, even when I was a young boy of Limerick. I mean, Bud Ahern was a star. And, I mean, obviously he left Limerick. He probably would have left Limerick sooner, only for World War II. But, I mean, he had great success with Belfast Celtic and then obviously with Luton Town. Played for both national sides and played so often and became such a regular. Mm. And he played on so many huge occasions. He has to be talked about as one of the greats. And I think really that's all you can say. Yeah. And okay, we can have our conversations. We can have our arguments. Mm. Was Bud Ahern a better fullback than Steve Finnan? I mean, how can I even answer that? I never saw him play. I haven't even, right, we might have the odd little bit of grainy footage, but I'm going by newspaper reports. I'm going by the stories that the old men and the popular side used to tell in the 70s, you know. So how do you compare the greats of yesteryear with the greats of, well, recent times?
Absolutely, yeah. We don't. We just appreciate them, I think, is the key.
Gary talking to me about Bud's international career, but what about Luton Town FC, where he spent most of his club career and where he worked and settled down? Well, William Foster is from Hatters Heritage, a Luton Town FC historical charity. And before I talked to him about Bud, I asked what exactly was Hatters Heritage.
Yeah, so we're a charity that was set up about 7 years ago now. Our chairman is the club historian Roger Wash, so he's been involved for about 40 years with documenting the history of the club. And like I say, about 7 years ago he realized, so I've been around his house, and his house is just full of Luton Town memorabilia. He has two lofts just full of Luton Town stuff. And about 7 years ago he realized he really needs to find a way of digitizing what he has, so that project was started. So our main source of information for people now is we have a website, hattersheritage.co.uk, and that covers the history of the club back to 1885. So we have a match report for every game played. We have photos for a huge amount. We have match programs for every Luton game from 1935 onwards, pretty much.
Wow.
Yeah, when I wasn't involved in the project at the start, but the first web company they spoke to when Roger said what he wanted to do, they looked at him like he was mad and said, that's just not possible. But he underestimated us football nerds. That was one of the problems. So we're really proud of it. And we'd love anyone to come and have a look. We think it's a really good resource, obviously primarily for Luton fans, but we have, you know, the away programs as well. So for fans of other teams, you can read it in PDF on the site. And there's lots of articles about old players and things like that. So, yeah, we think it's a really good resource for all football fans, and we're really happy with it.
Yeah, it sounds like a real kind of football nerd's paradise where you can just open up programs from, you know, 1952 or something and see what was happening, what people were talking about. I suppose in the bigger picture as well, because obviously it's something that we're big fans of as well. What does it mean, I suppose, for Luton Town and to be able to hold firmly onto that kind of that heritage that isn't just from 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, but it's right back to the early stages of the football club and key moments in football club as well?
Yeah, I think in that regard, we're no different to any other club. I think, you know, most of us would agree there's been this trend recently to think football was invented in 1992 when the Premier League started. And, and given that we were relegated out of the top flight the season before the Premier League started, we don't really like that viewpoint. So to us, we like to tell the history of the club, and not just the history, but that then blends into the history of the area as well. And especially when you look back at the people involved on the administration of the club in the early days, which sounds quite dry, but when you look at some of the stories of some of these Victorians who were involved in setting up the football clubs and running them, they really are fascinating stories of people who, you know, served in all kinds of areas in the town and, you know, did a great job of helping the community and helping the people. So that story of the football club quickly turns into something broader, I think. And I just think for all clubs, it's brilliant. We have, you'll find with most clubs, they tend to have one or two people who have held on to the history and documented it. And it's such a brilliant local resource in so many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Our own Gary Spain on the show, I think, would probably agree with that. He's the first one into the media box for the team sheets and the programs and so on and stuff like that as well. But it's also an important part as well in terms of heritage and history, not just for Luton Town, but for football as well, to understand, the history behind football and where football has come through the decades and down through the years as well.
You know, we like to tell the stories that were happening at the time and the stories of opposition players. For instance, I write a program article for the match programs, and last season we did one on Stanley Matthews and how his links with Luton as well, and how his career intersected with Luton's. And we've got people who are specialists in the Victorian era as well. And all the different things that were going on then. So you never really keep it to just Luton. It always explodes into something a bit more. And I think it's vital that we have people who record that kind of thing.
Absolutely, yeah, 100%. And along those lines, part of the reason, obviously, or the reason why we have you on the show is to talk about one of our own famous sons and one of your own famous sons at Luton as well, which is Tom Butterhearn as well, who came over from Belfast Celtic after coming from Limerick as well. So maybe give us a little insight into where Luton is before he comes, because it's the shadow of World War II that we're coming out of.
Yeah, so Luton had been formed in 1885, a merger of two local clubs. We were in the Football League towards the end of the 19th century for three seasons, but they resigned in the 1899-1900 season because it was just too expensive. So they resigned, moved back into the Southern League, which was a big risk because they didn't know if the Southern League would take them or not, but they did. Then we were in the Southern League up to the end of World War One, when it expanded, the Football League expanded to include third division. So we joined the third division south. And that's where we stayed pretty much as a mid-table team throughout the 1920s. Then what started to happen in Luton, and this might surprise people a bit, because I think there's a general view of Luton, I don't know if you see it much, but the worst towns of the UK, and it's always us or Slough, in a competition to see who can win that.
It's not a competition you want to win, though, is it?
No, but you have to take what you can, So, at least we haven't got a John Betjeman poem about us. So what might surprise people about Luton is, because up until probably the late 19th century, Luton was a tiny little village, essentially. And then it starts to grow. Then it starts to swallow up the little villages around it. And there's lots of space to grow into. We have two railway lines running through the town. So industry really starts to grow. And by the time you reach the 1930s, it's a really quite prosperous place. So we have some big industry in the town. Things like Skefco ball bearings were located in the town. Vauxhall Motors would be the one, I suppose, most people linked to Luton, and that's been a huge employer. So there was a lot of money in the area as we move into the 1930s. We had a chairman by the name of Charles Jeaves, who made it his mission to make the club, well, first of all, get into the second division and then into the first. So there was some near misses. Probably the most famous thing that happened around that time was 1936, Joe Payne, who would play for England. He scored 10 goals in one game against Bristol Rovers, which is still the record.
Wow.
For an individual game, 10-goal Payne, yeah. So then in terms of Ireland as well, just to go back, so we actually had a couple of Irish internationals in the 1920s, Alan Matheson and Lewis Bookman. Mm. So I don't know if you've come across Lewis Bookman, but he's a fascinating story. So he was born in Lithuania, the Jewish faith, and his family left Lithuania because of being persecuted. They were supposed to be going to New York. But the story is, and I hope this is true, is that Lewis's father misheard the captain and alighted at Cork by mistake. So he stayed in Cork. He never wanted Lewis to be a footballer. Lewis had a really good career at a lot of different clubs. And yeah, he was capped by Ireland. In one game, England against Ireland, we had three players on the pitch, one for England and two for Ireland as a third division club. So it's always been some Irish links there. Yeah. So anyway, so they were finally promoted in 1937 into the second division. And we're actually going really well at that point. So we had some local players coming through. And actually, when football was suspended in 1939-1940, we were top of the second division. It was only three games, but we were top of the second division. So there's a great line in the local paper about, you know, Hitler better not come around here or be in big trouble.
Our going is good. You better not ruin this, Mr.
Yeah,
Hitler.
Exactly. How dare you? Yes. So obviously, like most, you know, a lot of clubs, we lost some of our best players when we actually, you know, some passed away. But, you know, just we had some, for instance, Hugh Billington was a local player who was a fantastic forward and was a top scorer in the entire country before the war. And obviously, you know, lost his best years. And by the time we come back after the Second World War, it becomes quite a bit more difficult. We're basically building a new team. And this is where Bud will come into the picture. So in 1948, we had a manager called Dally Duncan appointed, who started as a player manager. And then, obviously, I don't know if you've covered, but Bud was part of the Belfast Celtic team who were at Windsor Park and the famous sort of riot.
Riot, yeah.
And he was personally injured, I think, by the fans. And at that point, my understanding is he sort of thought there must be an easier life than this. Because I think Belfast Celtic were thrown out of the league, weren't they, is my understanding. So
it would have been closer around there, yeah, because what happened was they went on tour. They were in financial difficulty. They went on tour into the States, and by the time they came back, they were out of the league, basically.
Right. So Bud went on that tour. The club let him go.
Yeah.
So he played on the tour. But I think he was a Luton player at that point. So Luton were the first people to contact him, and we signed him for £8,000. I think he came over here with his brother Frank, or they came over at very much the same time. And they set up home here. So Luton at this point, you know, as I was saying, was big industry. We had big Irish population, and Bud would eventually settle in the Limbury area of the town, which is where I'm from as well. And there's a big Irish population there. So I imagine he always felt quite at home. He had his family around him here. And at first it took him a while because he had a bit of an ankle injury. So he didn't play much when he first came over. His debut was at Tottenham and we lost 2-1. But in the match report, it does say he played very well and makes particular point of the fact that he was very good at clearing with both feet, which is something you read about him quite a lot, that he was good on both, you know, on both feet. So he was primarily a left back in that old style of play, a full back.
Do you mind me asking, do we know, like, how did Luton spot him? How did they find out about him? Was it, did somebody kind of, did they have a scouting system or something like that, where somebody contacted the club and said, you have to get this guy? Or did somebody see him and go, geez, we got to get that guy in? Or was it word of mouth? Or
I have to admit, I actually don't know that. I haven't found anything out about that specifically. We did have quite a lot of Irish signings around that time. So I would imagine we had some kind of scouting system set up there, but I can't tell you specifically how Bud came to our attention.
I'd imagine with the proximity of Ireland and Northern Ireland as well, it probably wasn't that hard to get word to people about how good some of the players were that might have gone over at the time as well.
Exactly, yeah. One word from one person to another, right? So yeah, he comes over. The first few seasons were here a bit of a struggle. So what Luton's main problem was is they just didn't really have anyone to score the goals. And so, you know, you asked me why Bud was so fondly remembered. I think one thing is, if people remember, he was a part of a team that went on to be one of our best ever sides in the 50s. And he was one of the first there. And there's definitely a feeling that without him in that first couple of seasons, you know, in the early 50s, we'd probably have been relegated because goal scoring was a struggle. And he was a real, you know, what people would say, a class act, very experienced. He was 30 when he came over. So, you know, he knew his game. The things you read about him, I mean, I think what I pick up on is that you read almost everything about him, like every possible praise, which makes you think he was very much an all-round sort of player. You know, you see a lot of people talk about his positional sense. He just seemed to know where to be on the pitch. That for a fullback, he could pass like a midfielder is what you read, which wasn't that normal for the time. One of his other big benefits was that he was very robust. He very rarely missed a game. So, you know, a big thing then. And he always seemed to avoid injuries. He used to joke that he got more injuries from fellow Luton players during the game than the competition. So definitely that would have, you know, it's part of the reason why I think he's thought of very fondly by Luton fans, because, you know, we'd never have been able to lay the foundations for what came after that.
What kind of player was he? Was he, I mean, give us a little bit of maybe a spec on him. Was he a big guy? Was he small? Was he fast? Was he, did he just have a good perception of the game? And that's what is that?
Yeah. Like I say, I think it sounds a bit vague, but you do sort of read that he was good at everything really. That he probably wasn't the quickest, although, you know, I do see Rhett said about him that he was pretty pacey when he first came over. But obviously, as he got older, given that he was 30 when he came, he definitely would have slowed down a little bit. But yeah, I think a man that very much knew his own game, was unhurried. He liked to jockey the wingers as far as wide out as he could. And he always said that it was one of the reasons he enjoyed playing against Stanley Matthews and why he had such joy against him, because Stanley Matthews liked to stand on the wing as well. So that played into...
So Matthews was where he wanted him to be.
He was where he wanted him to be, and he was always... Stanley Matthews never scored against Luton when Bud was in the team. So it was something he was always very proud of. He never liked to talk about much about his career, but he would tell people that he kept Stanley Matthews quiet.
I mean, it's a hell of a boast to have, too.
It's not a bad one, no. So then, generally for Luton, things start to pick up. We had a lot of good local players start to come through, and a really important signing in about 1953 with Jesse Pye coming in, who was a vastly experienced striker, and he started to score the goals. And even more importantly, we had an inside forward called Gordon Turner. He was a Yorkshire lad, but we'd signed him after his national service. And he comes down and he's learning from Jesse Pye, and he'll go on to be Luton's record goal scorer. Very unlucky never to play for England. Scored most of his goals in the top flight. And, you know, with those goals coming now, we just miss out in 54, but then be promoted in 55 on goal average, which is as close as it could get. So us and Birmingham went up, and poor old Rotherham missed out, and Rotherham have never played in the first division. Yeah. So I'd imagine they hate us very much. So just some stories about Bud that I think tell you a little bit. So he was vice captain while he was here for a long time. Our captain was a guy called Sid Owen, who would win the Footballer of the Year award, actually. Another really interesting guy. He was at an advanced age, and he won the Footballer of the Year award, which I'd imagine a Luton player probably will never do again.
Hey, never say never. Never say never.
Never say never. No, it seems unlikely, though. So one of the things the club were trendsetters in terms of going on foreign tours. And for 1 year in particular, they were out in what I suppose then you'd call behind the Iron Curtain. And they were in Romania. Sid Owen wasn't there because he was with England B. So they're out in Romania, and Bud was sort of serving as captain, and it had it sprung on them that they had to play an extra game. And so Bud took on the shop steward role and said they wouldn't do that unless, you know, they were paid for this extra match. But we're talking about Romania in the 1950s here. So there was no shops open. So eventually the deal that was done was they brought all the players to a local warehouse, fitted them all out with what you'd imagine a communist era leather coats. And that was their payment for playing the game, which they accepted. So I do like the idea of them all standing around getting their leather coats.
using the old barter system of payment.
Yes, we'll pay if you give us a leather coat and a donkey. Yes. Yeah. So also around that, so then, Luton are promoted. So I think Bud now is 35 and he's an English first division player, which is incredible. We have a few.
I just want to ask, just maybe out loud for us as well, how important was that promotion and I suppose what did it give Luton Town now that they were at the top table of English football?
So it's very important in terms of the fact that eventually we reached the FA Cup final in 1959. We did unfortunately lose it, which is a painful memory for any of the players involved. For instance, our goalkeeper was a guy called Ron Bainham, who only passed away last year or the year before. And when he passed away, he was England's longest living international. We'd interviewed him a couple of years ago, and even now, even at that point, he still couldn't talk about the final because it was so painful. And so, to reach the first division. Yeah, I mean, it was a great time to do it in the 50s because crowds were as high as they ever were and probably still are now. And we had our record attendance around that time. And if you know Kenilworth Road at all, it's completely hemmed in by houses on all sides. So you can imagine we used to talk about having, the record attendance was 30,000. And you can only imagine that people were standing on top of each other to fit into the ground.
Trust me, there's many stories in Irish football as well. It's the sardine can. Nobody gets turned away at the turnstiles. You find a way to fit in. There is no health and safety.
There's a great little story about that as well, because in those days, so this was our record attendance was in that run to the FA Cup final in 1959. We had a replay against Blackpool in the quarter final. And in those days, the away team used to have to agree to use the floodlights. And Stanley Matthews was playing for Blackpool, and he didn't think much of Luton's floodlights, so he said no. So the game had to be played in the afternoon. So we had 30,000 people there. So Stanley Matthews is absolutely responsible for about 20,000 Luton school children missing a day of school. So in terms of, just in terms of Bud, so, Luton go up to the first division, we cope pretty well with it. And one of his favourite games he talked about, one of the few games he would talk about was in our second season. We started with three wins, one of which was at home to the Great Wolves side of the time. And then the fourth game was away at Wolves. We went into that top of the Football League, which was just incredible for Luton. And Bud was playing in the game at Wolves and, still called one of the best games people had seen. Luton went 2-0 up. Wolves came back to 3-2. Luton equalised again to 3-3. Wolves went 5-3 up and it ended 5-4 to Wolves. Billy Wright, the great Wolves player, said it was one of his favourite ever games as well. Mm. And just a fantastic time. Luton had some brilliant games back then that Bud was involved with, hammering the Bank of England Sunderland side 6-2 at home. So just it would have been a great time to watch football, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. Do we know, was there a particular reason why he didn't like talking about his football career other than the odd few times? Was it he didn't want to seem boastful? Was he an introverted kind of guy or what?
Yeah, that's the word you'd often read. He's very humble. And I read in an interview, he sort of took the view of my football life is over now. I'm not going to talk about that anymore. I'm sure he did at times, but he did serve as a youth coach with the club for a couple of years, but then he moved out of football altogether. Unfortunately, his career was ended pretty much in an away game at West Brom in 1957. He was on a really slushy, snowy pitch. And he does say, he'd slowed down a bit by this point, which is probably part of it, but he got a really bad ankle break and he never come back to first team football after that. He was still at the club when we reached the FA Cup final, but hadn't played for a couple of years. So a sad way to end, but you know, he was 38 by that point. So he'd played 288 times. He never scored. And he's second on that list behind another Irish player, Seamus Dunn, who he formed a really good, they were the fullback partnership between those two. And then there was sort of a Scottish-Irish rivalry at the club, a friendly rivalry at that time. So we had some Irish players like Bud and George Cummins, who played many times for Ireland as well, and was a fantastic, skillful player. Then on the Scottish side, we had people like Wally Shanks and Mike Cullen. So it was a Scottish and Irish thing going on.
Well, that Belfast Celtic team that he played for, they played Scotland when they were on that tour. They beat Scotland. And Scotland never played a club team ever again after that. So Bud and his Belfast Celtic team were responsible for Scotland never ever playing a club game ever again against teams either. So he obviously was part of something great with that as well. So, but I think one of the great things that seems to be about him is you mentioned he didn't score any goals, but I mean. That's exactly what you want, really, from your defenders, yeah. Isn't it? I mean, the modern defender, if you haven't got 5 or 6 goals in a season, it seems like a waste.
Yeah, and it was really part of how football was played in those days as well, I think. You didn't see defenders scoring many goals. It wasn't their job. And the fullback role then was almost more like a sweeper now, wasn't it? It was even further back on the pitch, so you wouldn't see fullbacks scoring many goals. But absolutely, it wasn't what his job was. And just some other interesting things. So he was about his personal life, he was a really good singer. Loved singing the Irish ballads. So we had a player, Bert Mitchell, who could play the piano. So for away games, when they'd get to the hotel, Bert Mitchell would get on the piano and Bud would have his couple of Guinnesses and then start to sing all the Irish ballads before the game, after the games. So he was... really good singer. He, when he finished football, he went to work for Foxhall, as most people in Luton did. He worked as a welder for 30 years. He had 5 children, 2 boys and 3 girls. He was very heavy. So he played well into his 40s for Luton Celtic. And the area he lived in, Limbury. So we've got a parish here called St. Joseph's, and they had a really notable non-league side. He was heavily involved with what we'd call the club. That's what we'd call them. So he'd sit in the door, sign people in. That was his go-to place, to go to church and then to the club for his Guinness afterwards. And everyone in the area I grew up in knew Bud from the club, as we'd say. And he was very, loved his golf. He'd walk up a couple of miles every day to play golf every day later in life. And he liked bowls as well. So he'd play bowls for local teams. So I think the word I've heard used about him is he's a man's man. everything you'd expect a guy of that sort of era to do, he enjoyed and did.
But it seems like he really loved the football life, in that he embraced it. You know, he was in a different country, which can sometimes be difficult for Irish people as well to settle in different countries too. Mm-hmm. But he seemed to really embrace it and really seemed to love it at Luton Town. You know, going to away games, sitting around a piano, having a few drinks, etc. It sounds like a guy who's just really happy with his football life.
I think he was. I think there's a couple of things to say about that. Firstly, I think coming to Luton was probably a great thing because we had such an Irish community. Mm. So, the area he would have lived in would have been like home from home, really. Mm. And then just obviously everything you read about footballers in the 50s, before and after, is just incredibly humble. Bud, for instance, he would have probably been paid £10 a week or £8 in the summer. So we've got a great picture of him on Hatters Heritage of him trying to earn a few bob in the summer by doing some labouring around Kenilworth Road. So just a picture of him labouring on the stadium. Yeah.
Wow.
It shows you the sort of the down to earth kind of people they were. So I think it was just a different world in that regard, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But I think, he had a brilliant career. to come over at 30, you know, an advanced age, and to get to play in the first division of English football against some of the great players of that era, all of the great players of that era, household names, you know, must have been incredible. And then, you know, I think there's something commendable about then he, you know, that life's over, and then he, you know, just starts what you'd say a normal life, you know. I mean that in the nicest possible sense of finds a job and does it for 30 years and looks after his family and is part of his community, a very strong part of his community. Mm-hmm. He passed away in 1999. Just one story I wrote about Bud in the for the program last year, and they took this story out, but I really like it. So sadly, Bud had Alzheimer's, and but he'd still go and play golf. And he's out one morning playing with one of his sons. He comes home, and his wife said to him, "Who are you playing with?" And so Bud's sitting there for a minute. He can't remember the name, and he just says, "The fat one." they took that out of the program article, unfortunately. I thought it was a great little story. His funeral was at St. Joseph's, the club I was talking about, and the church was packed. And Wally Shanks, who played with him, I mentioned, he was a Scottish guy, and he said something I thought was really nice in the reading he gave. He said, "Bud was a very hard, 100% type of player, a nice guy and a real Irishman." And I think that sort of sums him up very well.
Really well, yeah. And it seems extraordinary that, you know, it's been, what is it now, 57, so 68, 70 years since he probably last kicked a ball for Luton Town. But yet the club still remembers him. He still remembers the impact that he had. Why do you think, even after all this time, people still have an affection for Bud?
So I think part of it is what I said. I think the fact that, so with Luton, we have two great eras of players. We have the 50s and we have the 80s. And there'll be arguments between people about which is our greatest team. So the 50s team were the first to get to the first division. They got to the FA Cup final. The 80s team were in the first division for 10 years and won the League Cup. And so, you know, people have differing opinions, but Bud was obviously a massive part of that 50s team. He was one of the first, you know, of that team that would eventually become the legendary 50s team. And I think people appreciate that he was a humble man, that he was just, a good guy. And I think, you know, for the Irish population of Luton as well, he is the Irish Luton footballer, really. You know, he was the first really famous one. And I do think that feed into a little bit. But I think, yeah, being part of all of that team for us in the 50s, names like Sid Owen and George Cummins and Bob Morton, for Luton fans, they are the legendary players of that era, and Bud is definitely part of that.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Fantastic career. And, we talked about it in this podcast as well with Gary. He was part of some very, very famous Irish wins as well, 1-1 away in Spain in a famous victory. Obviously, beat England at Goodison Park for a famous victory. The first foreign team, I suppose, to beat England in England as well. So, huge results that he was a part of in his international career as well. So, it's testament to him and his abilities as well as a defender and as a player that, you know, he is both part of one of the most famous Luton sides and Luton periods in their history, and also part of some very, very famous Irish victories as well. And I suppose that sums it up really nicely of his talents and his skills.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I mean, it's great. I know you could tell he obviously loved to play for Ireland. He's the only Luton player to be capped by two different countries, right, as a Luton player. So he played for the North and the South. And yeah, in an interview our historian did with him in the early 90s, he particularly mentioned the Goodison game as it was one of his favourites. So he was very proud to play for his country, it always seems like. And, he was our most capped player actually for a while. So that definitely probably helped raise Luton's profile amongst Irish players as well.
Yeah.
You talk about people like George Cummings coming in. The fact that we had a strong core of Irish players already would probably have helped with that. So that was a good thing for Luton as well.
He was also part of a famous match, which was against Wales, which was the very last match that you could be dual selected. So he played in the very last match against Wales as well. So it's a fantastic career. So I suppose in terms of Luton Town, where do you put Tom Butterhearn in terms of your historical players? And I suppose maybe not make comparisons between which team was best, but maybe talk to us a little bit about where does he stand in the pantheon of Luton Town.
You wouldn't want to single him out amongst any of that 50s team. We had some brilliant players, and I think all of them are held in extremely high regard. So I think he's probably an extra special player for people like myself that, you know, from an Irish background, I think, being, like I say, the first real, really famous Irish heritage player, I suppose I'd say, although we've had plenty of others. Bud was the one I think most people would associate most when you talk about an Irish football player from that era. Just that really, I think. If you were making a team of an all-time Luton 11, I think many people would have Bud in there at fullback.
Wow.
So that in itself is probably quite high praise, yeah.
Fantastic. I suppose maybe give us a little snapshot. How's the team doing now?
Okay, you depressed me. The thing about being a Luton supporter is there's no point worrying about the ups and downs to some regard because it's just constant. So, it's never boring at least. So we had a great run after we fell into the non-league. We were there for 5 years and then come up back out in 2014, and we appointed Nathan Jones as manager, and we had a fantastic spell that culminated in promotion to the Premier League 2 years ago and made a really good fist of it. Unfortunately, it wasn't quite enough. It's been a bad time since then. I think the club has really struggled with what the Premier League brought,
yeah.
In terms of the changing expectation of the players, in terms of just how it affected everything. We've never been a club with money, you know, and we've always operated on that sense of finding bargains and getting the most out of players. And when you suddenly take in £180 million of Premier League money, you know, it changes everything. And as well as that, the thing about Luton is we, for the last 70 years, we've been moving to a new ground. And it finally looks like it's happening. So we have a space on what was an old power station. So it's called Power Court. It's a huge project, but it's right in the centre of town. So it's fantastically located. It's not going to be one of these new grounds that's in an industrial estate on the edge of town. But it's a huge project. It's been going on for many years, and a lot of things have obviously come along to make that more difficult. And then a lot of the funds we took in the Premier League have been earmarked for that ground, which I think most of us are absolutely fine with.
Yeah.
So they're hoping to move in 2028. It will be 23,000 capacity, which is good because Kenilworth Road now is generally full every week. Mm. So it's very hard to get new fans in. So it's been tough, two relegations in a row. We've just brought in Jack Wilshere, the ex-Arsenal player who actually started at Luton as an eight-year-old. He lives in the area and he's our youngest ever manager. I think he's only, so certainly very close to it. He's only 33 years old. So it's going to take him time. That's, you know, it's hard to drop a 33-year-old in, expect it to work straight away. And we've seen some good signs, but you know, I think we just need to stabilize a little bit. It's been a absolutely mad few years. Mm. And I think a bit of stability now, hopefully get back up into the Championship, which is, I think, where most Luton fans feel like is a nice place to be. And hopefully then with a new ground coming along at that point, have been in good stead. But you never know with Luton; it just it's up and down constantly. You know, we in the after you talk about that golden era of the 50s, we then dropped down into the fourth division in the 60s within 7 years, then come back up to the first division in the 70s for one season, then hung around the second division for a while, then obviously had a really great era of 10 years in the first division, what was then, you know, what is now the Premier League, then got relegated the year before the Premier League started, just typical of Luton, and then dropped down to the fourth division again. So you can see it's just up and down, up and down. So one thing he's learned to live with as a Luton fan.
The highs and lows, the agony and the ecstasy, of going up and down and around the place as well as a football club. But I suppose that's why we love it too.
It's better than, I think, you know, I look at these teams who stay in the same division for years on end and I think that must be so boring.
Yeah. throw yeah. a bit of relegation in there. Have a bit of spice.
Yes.
Feel our pain.
17 promotion and relegations in
4 years. Will, if people want to find out more about the history and heritage of Luton Town, how did they do that with Hatters Heritage?
Yeah, please come on the website. It's just hattersheritage.co.uk. Hopefully it's easy to navigate around. And like I say, if you're a fan of an opposing team, you can look at Luton matches by opposition. And we've got lots of programs and player photos on there. So by all means, we're on Twitter as well. If you'd like to follow us on there, we put some old photos up on there as well. So, yeah, we'd love people to come to the site and just have a look around.
Fantastic. Will Foster from Hatters Heritage, thank you very much for joining us and giving us a fantastic insight into one of our legendary own and one of your own legendary owns as well in Tom Butterhearn.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
William Foster there from Hatters Heritage. That website again is hattersheritage.co.uk. That's hattersheritage.co.uk, where you can find out more about the history of Luton Town and indeed some of the many other Irish players that have graced the pitch at Kenilworth Road. Well, that's it for this week's podcast and our look at Tom Butterhearn, one of our greatest ever footballing sons. Don't forget to share the show on your own social media channels to let more people find out about the history and heritage of Irish football. And why not share your own stories out there while you're at it? Turn on your notifications on whatever podcast platform you use so that you can get notified straight away when a brand new episode drops. And remember, support your local League of Ireland and Northern Ireland Football League teams. It's our heritage. It's our game. Bye for now.